From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we look at the vaccine rollout in Milwaukee and learn about the different ways people may get it. Then we'll learn about a new film that documents the importance of the Latino community to Wisconsin's culture.
The community has grown in terms of the economic importance, in terms of jobs, schools, just the impact is tremendous. And so we wanted to tell that story.
Plus, we speak with the Forest Home Cemetery historian to learn about the art and symbolism found on gravestones.
Well, I think it's trying to solve the mystery, understand the story that's being told by the individuals so that as time passes, they are remembered.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for tuning in today. Today, we'll look at the state of Milwaukee's economy and how the economic downturn caused by the pandemic has impacted the city. We'll learn about a new documentary that looks at the ways the Latino community has changed and improved the state. And we'll also learn about art and symbolism found in Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery. We'll start with this. The nation's COVID-19 vaccine rollout so far has been chaotic and confusing. Although the federal government is supplying vaccines, distribution has been left to individual states, and the process for widespread vaccinations is still unclear. Dr. Heather Parody, medical director for the Milwaukee Health Department, joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to shed some light on the process here in Wisconsin.
Right now, do we have a timeline for when we think everyone in the state of Wisconsin, but specifically here in Milwaukee, will be able to be vaccinated?
The first allocations of the COVID vaccine have gone to healthcare systems who are focused on vaccinating their frontline employees, those who are at highest risk of contracting COVID because of their daily activities at work. I think that the fluidity of this situation with respect to vaccine, so how much is coming to the state, and similarly, how and when the state is able to expand that distribution of vaccine to other entities and other vaccinators, is still taking shape. What we do anticipate is that this 1A group, the frontline healthcare workers, as well as residents and workers within long-term care facilities and nursing homes across our state, is likely to take at least the first month of 2021 and likely into the beginning of February before we start to see a transition to the next phases of vaccine allocation.
You mentioned the 1A group, and I'd like to get back to that in just a moment, but I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about how this process is really happening. There are politicians who have made it seem like vaccine distribution is being led by the federal government, and specifically President Trump's Operation Warp Speed. But as I've dug into this story, that doesn't seem to be the case. Who is really in charge of this process here in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee?
So Operation Warp Speed at the federal level is securing much of our initial doses and phases of vaccine. And at the state level, the vaccine is coming through our Department of Health Services, or DHS. So the state is processing those applications and similarly is handling the large shipments of vaccine and distributing the vaccine to those recognized entities that have gotten through the application process to become approved vaccinators.
Okay, so to clarify, the federal government is or has been responsible for getting the vaccines from these companies. And then essentially, the Department of Health Services at the state level is sending these vaccines to different healthcare facilities who will then, are they deciding who will get the vaccine or are they just responsible for administering it to people?
So at the state level, they are processing applications, ensuring that individual entities who are applying to be vaccinators meet all of the requisite requirements and are able to store the vaccine in the ways that are necessary, that are specific to the individual vaccines that are coming out, as well as the ability, the infrastructure, the other logistics and operations that are necessary in order to actually get it into the arms of individuals that it's intended.
So who is deciding whose arms are getting it? Who's deciding the order of who gets the vaccine first?
So in large part, we, public health, healthcare entities, and others are following the guidance that has been put forth by both the CDC as well as the ACIP committee that advises on vaccine distribution to individuals during times such as this, where demand is larger than the vaccine supply.
What does that list actually look like?
The way that vaccine prioritization has been recommended during these initial phases of vaccine rollout is to first prioritize within what is being called a 1A group. And that 1A group specifically is healthcare providers. So individuals who are either providing direct health care or working directly with people or specimens where they might be at higher risk for coming in contact with COVID because of their daily work activities. So that might include healthcare providers, it might include laboratory workers, it might include others who are in those types of environments and settings. The other group that has been prioritized for that Group 1A vaccine distribution is individuals who live in or work in assisted living and nursing home settings.
I've gotten this question from a few people in my life who are elderly, who have some pre-existing conditions that would make them higher risk of getting COVID-19, but they live independently. And I think this is a question that really speaks for a lot of people right now. How do they get the vaccine? Even though they're high risk, they don't live in a facility with other people, a long-term care facility. How do they get it?
Yes, that's a great question. And one that we've been fielding lots of calls about. Those individuals who are of advanced age and may have some associated health risk factors and who are living independently would fall into the next phase of prioritization according to the guidance that has been given. So a phase 1B, specifically those individuals who are 75 years and above, as well as individuals who are considered frontline essential workers. So people like first responders, individuals who cannot perform the duties of their jobs remotely, whose jobs bring them into frequent contact with members of the public and or are working in settings where it is very difficult to social distance from their workmates.
My partner is a UPS driver. In Milwaukee, if you're someone who is a UPS driver or is someone like a grocery store worker, someone who is dealing with people on a daily basis, as you say, can't really do their job without being in contact with other people, would they fall under our 1B category? Or is that really something that isn't clear for us quite yet?
Individuals who are employed through municipalities, so for instance, city workers, as a health department, we're currently working through some of those logistics of how individuals might be phased from a vaccinating our city workforce standpoint. There is active work taking place at both the city and the county level that we are also participating in that, to your point, is hosting conversations and understanding what types of networks and infrastructure are going to be necessary for the grocery stores, for the hotels, for the other operators within our city that don't fall under the city government structure.
Okay, so if you're someone who's, let's say, working at the local Pick and Save, it sounds like it wouldn't necessarily be incumbent on each individual to seek out the access to that vaccine, but rather the city, the county, the state are working on creating some kind of network to get this vaccine to people. Is that right?
Correct. Absolutely. And similar if you work in a manufacturing type of a role where you have to be on the manufacturing line every day, what we anticipate is that we will be working with many of the larger employers and will be creating pathways for vaccination of their individuals, and also recognizing that there are many, just like with healthcare providers, not everyone is affiliated with a larger entity or organization. And so also understanding what the catchment needs to look like for those individuals who may be independent or unaffiliated.
For unaffiliated people or people who work at smaller companies, this is definitely a concern. I think there's this idea that, well, there's a vaccine out there, but I don't know how I'm going to get it. Is that something that will ultimately be under the purview of the city, the county, the state, or for someone like me even, who can work fully at home, should I be contacting my healthcare provider saying, hey, whenever this is available to me, I'd like to get it?
Yeah, I do believe that there are going to be many pathways that are created to disseminate vaccine. So through health systems and individual health providers is certainly one route that we anticipate. Public health is another route. And as I said, pharmacies and pharmacists, just like with the COVID testing landscape, we see all those individuals playing very important roles, and there will likely be others that come onto the scene for vaccination.
As you mentioned, vaccinations have already started at long-term care facilities here in Wisconsin. They've also started for healthcare providers. Do we have an idea of when we might see more widespread distribution? As you say, access to the vaccine itself is pretty limited. It's unclear what it's going to look like in the future. But can you say whether we're talking about 6 months or a year?
So we're really hopeful that with continued vaccine production and distribution to states and to local authorities, that this period of scarcity will be relatively brief, say several months or through the first quarter of 2021, before we really start to see more widespread availability and much easier access for individuals who desire to be vaccinated.
To put a kind of date on it, do you think by next Christmas that people will have already been vaccinated?
Oh, I think by next Christmas we'll be looking at a very different sort of picture.
All right.
In terms of a vaccine. I want to point out, though, that until we hit a point of truly widespread vaccination of individuals, that it's going to be essential that we as a society continue to practice all of the measures that we've put in place for COVID. So wearing masks, keeping a physical distance, staying home when we're feeling ill, and frequently washing or disinfecting our hands and other surfaces.
Well, Dr. Parody, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Dr. Heather Parody is the medical director for the Milwaukee Health Department, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can always find the latest information about COVID-19 at WUWM.com, including the latest case numbers in the county and the state, as well as information about the vaccine rollout. We're also following a story about a pharmacist in Grafton who tried to spoil hundreds of doses of the vaccine. You can learn more about that at WUWM.com. Ahead, we'll learn about a new film that documents the importance of the Latino community to Wisconsin's culture. That's in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll compare the economic downturn caused by COVID-19 to the Great Recession in Milwaukee and hear what an economist says it will take for recovery. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The recession brought on by the coronavirus pandemic has not been equally distributed. The COVID-19 economic downturn was partly due to the decision to close many businesses early on to encourage people to stay home. But the effects have been lasting. Scott Adams is the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He says during the Great Recession, economists were able to see the trouble coming. But no one expected a pandemic to knock so many people out of work. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how the coronavirus recession compares to the Great Recession in Wisconsin.
So looking back at the year 2020, how do you think Milwaukee's economy did?
About as poorly as most cities its size. I don't think Milwaukee has had a very unique experience, mostly because this was so shocking to each state and each locality that it was a similar hit that Milwaukee took. The cities that tended to do the worst were cities with more lower wage service workers. Again, Milwaukee does have more than a share of that, but not the most. So, you know, we kind of find ourselves in the middle of the pack among cities our size. And I think if you were to look at cities across the country that are of similar size and demographics to Milwaukee, things would look roughly the same. We each had a very sharp decline, followed by a steep recovery, and now sort of teetering on the edge of being able to maintain the recovery that we had.
So when you're evaluating how you think that the Milwaukee economy is doing, what are some of the things you're looking at, and how does the unemployment picture play into that?
I mean, that's one of the only things we have now is the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate is fraught with problems, because if you just look at the unemployment rate, you're not dealing with people, and you know, I'm sure people have become aware of this over time. You're not dealing anymore. You throw out people who aren't looking for work. And who have dropped out of the labor force. And there's a ton of people who have done that because they have to care for children and who aren't in school. I mean, so you have all of these difficult things to measure. The unemployment rate has gone down to a level that's right where it was in, you know, not even in the recovery from the previous recession, back to when we thought the economy was pretty good, but not great in Milwaukee in 2017. It's right to about where it was then. But Milwaukee, like everyone else, is kind of holding our breath. And in the meantime, some small businesses are closing because they can't hold on anymore. You know, we underappreciate that they offer so much more than just a meal. I mean, they offer the flavor of the city, and we all benefit from the fact that they exist, even if we don't always go and shop at a store. I mean, we the fact that they exist make Milwaukee and other cities like ours what they are. And the Milwaukee that we'll see when we're all out and about in 8 to 10 months will look a lot different than the one that we loved before. And I think it behooves us to try to find ways to just allow the support to get to those places.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I think is the hardest to measure, is what are you losing as far as what does a neighborhood look like in Milwaukee now before the pandemic? And as someone who like loves restaurants and loves traveling, there's a certain flavor and culture with every neighborhood that you can pretty easily lose in a recession. So just thinking about that, how does this recession due to coronavirus compare to the Great Recession for Milwaukee, for Wisconsin?
What the difference is the Great Recession, we had a situation that was caused by a financial crisis. Usually recessions are caused by something that went fundamentally wrong with the economy, you know, whether it be, oil prices skyrocketing and people, you know, cutting into people's incomes, or we've had those, and we've had the subprime mortgage crisis that then trickled it. So the last recession was slow, and it kind of dragged out longer, and the recovery dragged out longer. But the pandemic occurred, and we had to actively shut down our own economy, which at the time was doing pretty well. So in that sense, you had all sorts of businesses that were preparing for a great spring, a great summer. The convention was coming to town. There was great optimism among the businesses and among the people, and that there were preparations for build. So, and it all came crashing down, and it had to become crashing down. The Great Recession was sort of a train wreck that you saw coming from 100 miles away. And it was slow and painful, and the recovery was slow and painful. This was just fast and sudden. And in that sense, it was different because this one should have been much easier to solve. And to an extent, we solved it initially by getting the stimulus checks out, by getting the small business loans out. It wasn't perfectly done. It probably didn't go far enough, but it was enough to keep us going and get us that recovery and give some businesses hope to reopen. And you did see that. You did see the service sector bounce back a little bit. But now that we've had a second wave, consumers are even now more cautious about what's going to be happening. Their optimism is relatively low. There's little incentive for restaurants or other local businesses to invest because there's just so much uncertainty about what things are going to look like. While we did bounce back to a point, we sort of did not provide enough help to keep the recovery going.
How does the economic situation that we're seeing in Wisconsin and of course across the country as well impact individual Wisconsin families? What does it look like to them?
Oh, it's absolutely devastating to many families. People are losing their homes. These are very dangerous things that are happening to people. And this recession has not hit equally. There are a group in the economy that have savings, that have job security, and they look at this as more this, and I'm afraid a lot of people look at this pandemic as more of an inconvenience. But there are people whose lives have been exploded. And I don't think we appreciated up until this point as economists how much people truly were living paycheck to paycheck. And when they lost a paycheck, they couldn't pay the rent. And the level of debt people held has become far more salient. We do have a debt crisis among a large proportion of our population, and this is just highlighting the amount of debt people are in. And that's going to hurt a recovery because people will be fearful now to spend because they know they're paycheck to paycheck. People will be more cautious in spending. So I think in a sense, that's something that hasn't gotten enough consideration, that we need to be considering debt relief and moratoriums on eviction as not just a humane thing to do, but as an essential way to keep the economy running.
As an economist, what are some of the things that you feel you've discovered about people's economic situations due to the challenges the pandemic has presented for individual families or just individuals?
No one saw this coming. These are people, and people are the economy. The economy is not some, third rail that we're not all a part of. We're all in this economy together. And I think we discovered how interconnected we are in that sense. But while there is interconnectedness, how disconnected the top of the income distribution is to the rest of this. We've seen massive wealth gains during this recession among the wealthiest people. there's more wealth now being moved toward the very top of the, and we already had a difficult issue with inequality. You know, you sort of learn each one. We saw this in the previous recession, but you see it in this recession. If you have an economic downturn, it doesn't affect everyone. It just exacerbates the existing inequalities that we have in our system.
Considering these difficulties, what else are you paying close attention to when evaluating the health of our economy, both here in Milwaukee and in the Wisconsin area?
Really, I'm looking to see, because it's the data are difficult. You're just kind of waiting to see ultimately the public health measures are saying now. I mean, that's ultimately what has been driving, this flattening of the upswing. We've had a surge, and that's kind of caused people to take a step back in their spending and in their business confidence. That's what I'm looking at now. You know, I'm looking at the health, because I think ultimately get the rate at which we can get control of the virus, the rate at which we can get people vaccinated. Then what you might see first to show that the economy is maybe headed in the right direction is when all the kids are back in school. And then once we have all the kids back in school, there's a sense of normalcy. Then I think, you know, then you'll see the economy start to improve. And we still don't know that, because we don't know what's going to happen in January. We don't know how quickly people are going to get vaccinated. We don't know whether or not people are going to continue to the extent needed the social distancing and the public health measures that are necessary to keep the economy on the level it is and have a chance to get back to a point where we could feel confident again. That's what I'm looking at, and that's why I say really can't separate the public health from the economics, because we don't get the economics data really until after that and to know what things are looking like.
Scott Adams is the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about Wisconsin's economy and how the pandemic led to a recession. Later on in the show, we'll speak with Paul Hawbrick, Forest Home Cemetery historian, on the symbolism that can be found on the grounds, from massive mausoleums to modest headstones.
The newfound wealth that develops in the U.S. after the Civil War plays a role in people identifying their place in society by the monuments that they have.
But first, we hear from longtime Milwaukee journalist Georgia Pabst about her documentary, Latino Wisconsin, which shares stories of Latinos living and working here. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For 4 years, Milwaukee journalist Georgia Pabst and media producer Ralph Pabst worked to document the Latino community's impact on Wisconsin. Narrated by voices in the Latino community, the film Latino Wisconsin looks at five regions of impact, from farm workers to future entrepreneurs. Georgia Pabst spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar about the film, and she begins by explaining how her work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel ultimately led her to this project.
I left the Journal Sentinel at the end of 2014, as you said, after 30 years of covering a lot of stories. But one of the things that I did cover was the Latino community and Latino issues, because I'm fourth generation Mexican American. It's a subject that's interesting of me personally and professionally, and so I knew a lot about the subject, and I had seen and watched the community grow over 30 years. And so when I left the paper, I wanted to do something else, and I thought, I've got all this information, all this background on the community, what can I do with it? And a lot had been written about the history of the community, but I wanted to do something bigger. And the last 25 years, not that much had been written about or filmed about the community. And in the last 25 years has been significant changes, significant growth, significant expansion of the community beyond the South Side, throughout the state. It's grown, the community has grown in terms of the economic importance, in terms of jobs, schools, just the impact is tremendous. And so we wanted to tell that story.
When you were reporting, did you come across stories that you filed away in the back of your mind because you couldn't, you know, give them necessarily the time or the resources or tell them in the way that you wanted to tell them, but that did come across in this documentary?
Honestly, no. What happened was when I left the paper, kind of standing back, I was able to say, look at all of this stuff that I know, all these information that I have, all these people that I have interviewed. And I would like to tell a bigger story, you know. So the bigger story idea occurred to me afterwards, after I had time to think about it and try to figure out how to tell a bigger story. Because we've thought that all these little stories along the way were great, but there hadn't been a really big story. So my inclination was to write a book, and my husband, who had been discussing these ideas with me and who has been familiar with the work in the community as well, said, why don't we do a documentary? It's a very visual story. We could work on it together, and it's something that we could produce to give to the community. It's almost like a legacy project, something that we hope would have value, that could stand the test of time, and that we could kind of be proud of. And so we embarked on a documentary, neither one of us having made a documentary, of course, but, you know, that's a small point. So we just started, and I started calling up people that I knew and said, hey, can you sit down with us and talk about, you know, yourself, your story, your history? And they said, sure. People were very nice. I was lucky that I built this, Rolodex of amazing people throughout my career. And people were really welcoming and very helpful and gave us a lot of their time to tell their stories. So our premise was the impact, influence, and importance of the Latino community to the state of Wisconsin. That was our premise. That was our working goal. And so we started with that. At first we thought we'll do Milwaukee, but the story is bigger than Milwaukee. So we said we have to do it statewide. And of course that made it harder, take more time.
That's crazy. Georgia, I'll just say that.
Like, I know.
You say statewide, that sounds so ludicrous to me.
And if you think about it, it is. But I mean, and that's sort of an exaggeration as well, because as I said, we couldn't cover everything. So we had to pick some things that would be representative of a statewide impact. So one, of course, was the dairy industry. Latinos and immigrant labor, incredibly important to the immigrant community and to the agricultural community, to the harvesting and food processing. Of course, Latinos have been doing that, have been working in the fields in central Wisconsin since the 40s. So that's, you know, we had to talk about that.
And Georgia, why did you start with that? That is chapter one, the dairy farmers.
We started with dairy farmers because dairy is the signature industry of Wisconsin. We're the dairy state. And the dairy state would collapse, according to farmers in the farm industry, the dairy industry, were it not for immigrant labor, Mexican immigrant labor. And as the film says, you know, more than 40%, probably now more than 50% of the milk harvested is done by immigrant labor. Huge significance. In the state, people traditionally grew up on the farm. They stayed on the farm. They worked on the farm. Kids, you know, a lot of the children of those farmers have left. They don't want to do that anymore. You can't get people to milk the cows. The cows have to be milked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year round, period. And it was getting to the point where, as John Rosenau, our principal dairy farmer in the film, says, he couldn't work anymore. He couldn't get enough help to work with him, and he just was, desperate to stay in business and to get the job done. And so he turned to Mexican immigrant labor. But the impact on the state, $43 billion a year. We toyed with the idea of not starting with dairy. But if we're talking about the importance, that's really important.
I mean, Absolutely. It is not some obscure industry in this state. It is one that strikes at the very identity of Wisconsin. Like, we have dairy land, you know, dairy on our license plates.
Exactly. And, you know, we everybody eats cheese and ice cream and curds and all that. And the thing is that, you know, we thought, some people think, well, that's been written about a lot. And it has. But we've also been surprised that a lot of people said, I didn't know that. And I don't know why people don't know that, but we wanted to tell them that. And we thought that was important to start with that, just because it's Wisconsin, it's dairy, and the impact of immigrant Mexican labor is so key to that industry.
I want to say that something that struck me about white, older voices who are residents of rural communities, I'm thinking of the interviews that you did in Arcadia, Wisconsin. I was surprised to see these people speak positively about immigrants and to say that they welcome immigrants into their community. And for me, that was surprising because a lot of rural Wisconsin is mostly white and in a stronghold for President Trump, who has spoken so disparagingly against Latino immigrants.
True. And the voices that we have on the film were people who could see the value of Mexican immigrants and Latino populations. You know, some people in the film were a little more reticent. They were a little bit more diplomatic. You know, people don't necessarily like change. That's a way of saying we don't like change, because change means things are different. But there is an acceptance, I think, if somewhat reluctantly so, that this, in fact, is the future, and that their towns and communities are changing, and they're changing of necessity because they need the workers, they need the students, they need the revenue. People are buying houses, they're building. They're part of the future.
Georgia Pabst, freelance writer and longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, thank you so much for your time and for speaking with me.
Georgia Pabst is the co-producer of the documentary Latino Wisconsin. You can find a link to the film at WUWM.com. Cemeteries not only serve as final resting places, but as storytellers. One of the ways individuals and families share something about their lives is through monument design. At Forest Home Cemetery in Milwaukee, thousands of gravestones show art and symbolism unique to their history, from the obvious Christian cross to symbols of mourning, achievement, and even hobbies. To help teach us more about the meanings behind these markers, I'm joined by Paul Hawbrick, Forest Home Cemetery historian and tour guide. He begins by explaining some of the most common symbols to look for.
They depict occupation is one characteristic of it. They at times depict a person's hobbies or their interests. They also depict religion, which is a very large symbolism topic. They also predict fraternal groups that people were members of, the Masons being the largest, and you'll see the symbol on the markers that are there. And there's a series of other things that have built up over time, but the great period of symbolism was in the Victorian era. And basically in the United States, that was the period of time after the Civil War until the First World War. Everything from flowers having a specific meaning, i.e. lily depicting purity, or oak leaves depicting someone who's a solid citizen in that concept that's there. So there were two things that were popular in the Victorian era. One was to use Greco-Roman symbolism, which is the temple, which is the primary one that they used. And the other were the Egyptian things that had become popular in the Victorian era, such things as an obelisk, sarcophagus. You'll see many large family monuments use a sarcophagus style for the family information, and then small headstones for each person. So all the emphasis was placed on the design that was used at that point. Mourning, as you indicated, is a common expression. Men may not like to hear this, but we only have women in mourning at the cemetery. There are no images of men in mourning. In terms of women in mourning, one of the more famous spaces at Forest Home Cemetery is called the Beer Baron Corner, where you have the Blatz family, the Schlitz monument, and the Pabst family. And the Pabst woman is in mourning. She's head down, very mournful. And in the Schlitz monument, it's a woman standing on top of the monument, pointing to heaven. And that's just the two different styles that are there.
Obviously, the range of markers at Forest Home or any cemetery range from small to massive and ornate. So when it came to incorporating symbols and having a bit more of a complex marker, was this something that usually only the upper class could partake in? I imagine this has always been a more expensive industry, a very labor-intensive thing to design and produce something.
Clearly, the newfound wealth that develops in the U.S. After the Civil War, when we have an expanding industrial base and wealth, plays a role in people identifying their place in society by the monuments that they have. And many of the monuments are not meant for one individual. They are meant to represent the family. And so they have that kind of aura about them, that they're large, important, significant individuals in the community. But the large cemeteries in the U.S., which are in what's called the garden style, which is Forest Home Cemetery, have a lot of the large statuary specific monuments in them, and they tend to be dominated by the very significant names of the community in that particular era.
What's a good example of a peak Victorian era monument we can find in Forest Home?
I think probably the most quintessential Victorian era image is an obelisk. They're large, they're tall, they have that unique feeling to them. And we have some really nice ones in the cemetery. One of the ones that I happen to like the most is the Luick family, L-U-I-C-K. If you were around in the day, you would have known that Luick was an ice cream company. The other things that are, I think, probably quintessential are both the urn, which you find on a lot of monuments. And the urn is Egyptian in nature. And then to stylize it, they would drape it with a piece of cloth that showed reverence for the person that was there. The original purpose of the urn was to take something to the afterlife, but it wasn't being used in that particular fashion here.
Also, something associated with the Victorian era, or of course the Industrial Revolution, but overall 19th century, that unfortunately was infant mortality, right? The rates were very high. It was 50% or more sometimes. So what kind of symbolism do we see in the markers of children's graves?
The most common symbol used is the lamb. And interestingly enough, we have a number of markers that have two lambs on them. And that meant that they were twins. And they don't have a name. And that means they were stillborn. Back in those days, you did not name, you do not name a stillborn child. And the reasons for that is that you didn't get your name until you were baptized. That was the thinking back in those days. The other symbols that we have for a child that's stillborn is an empty bed. And there's no name on it. And it generally just says babe or baby. And then if a child dies in the childhood years, and by the way, the childhood years are either 10 or 12, depending on the era that you're in. You grew up quite quick in the early industrial area because you went to work. And in those cases, the symbolism is a child lying in a bed. It's done in that particular fashion. But infant mortality rates in Milwaukee, as anywhere in the United States, were quite high until clean water and sewers came along. And then the public hygiene was increased and mortality rates began to decline. We have child sections at Forest Home back from the 1800s, and they're quite mournful. It's hard to go in and see how many children died. We actually have a couple of sections that are tied to local orphan homes. And back in those days, you would give a free burial to the orphan home. And it was a difficult time.
Yeah. Another marker or symbol found throughout cemeteries is a wreath. Can you explain what that means, whether it's etched onto the stone face itself, or perhaps an angel is holding one, or a woman even?
Yeah. Generally, it's a woman holding one, or it's on the monument itself. The wreath it's a laurel wreath, by the way, that's what it would be made of, or the makings of it, goes back to the original Olympics. When someone won a race, you were crowned with a laurel wreath. And so the symbol is one of victory. But the victory here is essentially the great Christian promise of the victory of life in the hereafter. So that the life in this world, which may have been hard in dealing, the life thereafter would be the great promise. So that's the symbolism there. So generally, when a person uses the wreath, they're telling you that they are a Christian. And while some of them may be large, frequently they're small on the marker, and you have to kind of get up close to be able to see them. But done in that particular fashion, it is the symbolism of the victory.
Also along the same lines of what we find in nature, of course, very interesting was trees, broken trees specifically. That's not something I even knew existed.
Yeah, it's very Victorian, but the broken tree was a symbol of death. And sometimes it's just a broken branch, but generally it's the trunk of the tree that is broken. Probably the best examples of this are what's known as a Bedford tree stone. They come from Bedford, Indiana, and they were marketed through the Woodmen of America, which today is an insurance. Back in those days, it was a fraternal organization with an environmental focus. And you could have the tree carved in many different ways, whatever fit or thing. It could be as small as 2 feet high, or our largest one is about 10 feet high. And then you could have carved onto the tree things that may have been interest to you. On one tree, person was obviously a gardener because the gardening tools are carved into the tree. Another person had an interest in horses, so the horses are carved into the tree. Our more interesting one that we've debated over the years is what it represents. We've decided it was a bundle of cigars, that the person was a cigar smoker, because we didn't know what it was. But back in the day, you could go to a tobacco store and buy a bundle of cigars that was wrapped with a ribbon. And that's what this is. So I don't know if today if people would memorialize themselves with their cigar, but there's probably a few people out there who would like to do that.
Probably. So when did people start turning away from buying and using large monuments with all these symbols and meanings to the more simplistic things we see today?
It's essentially World War I. World War I kind of ended that period of enlightenment that had begun in the 1800s and looking forward. And the war was devastating in terms of its death toll, its impact. And people began to move away from the larger symbols to symbols that are more simplistic. Basically, we went from what was known as a family lot to a mom and pop lot. Back in the day, everybody thought the family was going to stay together. In the modern era, we began to realize that families would be dispersed. And the markers don't carry a lot of symbolism. However, a new trend that I've noticed, but it's still gaining some steam, is the being able to use a laser to etch the image onto the monument that you want. First time I saw a person's image etched onto the monument, I wasn't comfortable with it because you were looking at the person who was dead. But it's becoming more popular, and they put more on. They'll put on their jobs, their hobbies, their cabin up north, all the different kinds of things. And lasers can do a remarkably good job on a piece of polished granite.
Well, and all these details are really interesting. It's not something that you'd initially think about when walking through a cemetery. You know, perhaps people just need to get comfortable with the idea of leisurely strolling through one. But what would you say to encourage them to look a bit closer at all the markers found?
Well, I think it's trying to be solve the mystery, understand the story that's being told by the individual so that as time passes, they are remembered. And you as walking through the cemetery will see it and you'll remember it. Often people are awed by the size of some of the monuments and that's what they remember. But most of them have some kind of symbol on them that tells you who they are or what they are. And it's interesting to know that.
Paul Hobrick is a tour guide and one of the historians of Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery. You can see photos of different monuments with the symbols we discussed, as well as learn more about the history of Forest Home at WUWM.com. That's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look back at the year in politics as we wrap up 2020 and look forward to 2021. We have the latest episode of How Did You Do That?, our podcast on entrepreneurship, plus why overdose deaths are on the rise in Milwaukee and what's being done about it. Join us again tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.